There's a great story I came across about, well, a strange story, really, a silly one, about a man with an intensely jealous streak who began to doubt whether his wife was being faithful to him. He got so upset about it that he devised a plan that one day he'd pretend to go off to work, would wait nearby, and then rush into the third floor flat where he and his wife lived, and he would be able to confirm his worst suspicions. So the next morning he kissed her goodbye, he went out of the flat, and he just hid round the corner, waited there, counted to 100, dashed back into the block of flats, up the stairs, opened the front door and saw his wife leaning, looking out of the window, smelling cigarette smoke. He thought the worst, glanced out of the window and saw a man down below climbing into a white open-topped sports car with a bunch of flowers. Absolutely enraged, he went back into the kitchen, ripped the fridge off the wall and threw it down from the balcony right on top of the man in the sports car. And the effort of it all was just too much for his heart. And that was the end of it. In the afterlife, as he arrived and he got there, they said to him, "Well, what happened to you?" He said, "Well, I had this insane jealousy," he said, "and I suspected my wife of being unfaithful, and I picked up a fridge to throw at the fellow, and, well, my heart packed up, and here I am." "Oh," they said, "well, you better wait over there." And as he went to sit down, a man came along with a big bandage wrapped around his head, limping on crutches, battered and bruised, and they said, "What happened to you?" He said, "You'll never believe this." He said, "It was the funniest thing. I was on my way to work, and I thought it would be nice to surprise my wife by nipping into the corner shop and buying her some flowers. I was just getting back into the car and I heard this whistling sound and I looked up and there was this gigantic fridge heading straight for me. And that was it." "Oh, wow. Well, you better wait over there." As he made his way over there, another fella came in, looking rather sheepish. "Well, what's your story?" they said. "Well," said the man, "I was hiding in this fridge. I sort of feel the story could have been made for our teacher in Ecclesiastes, couldn't it? I mean, the jealous husband, the innocent passerby, the guilty adulterer, and they all end up in the same place, dead. No wonder he thinks meaningless, meaningless, everything's meaningless." Now, if you've been with us earlier in the series, as he looked at life under the sun, in the here and now, as if that's all there is to life, you wondered sometimes, didn't you, why he bothered to get out of bed in the morning at all? I mean, life seemed empty, death inevitable. Any ace you might find, he was going to trump with that depressing certainty. Now, here he is saying, "Go for it." I mean, the mood swing seems remarkable. The antidepressants certainly seem effective. But don't be fooled. He's not suddenly abandoning all his research and becoming a starry-eyed romantic. He still sees life under the sun as meaningless. Just look across the page to chapter 12 and verse 9 and you'll see he's going to say it again before we finish. "Meaningless, meaningless," says the teacher. "Everything is meaningless, and yet..." As we come to chapter 11, this isn't even a grudging, "Well, I suppose you might as well go for it." This is his studied conclusion. "Go for it," he says. I've called it an agnostic's advice, and not because he's agnostic about God. He never has been a don't know when it comes to God, and you'll see here in this chapter, in verse 5, he speaks of God as the maker. In verse 9, God is the judge. Now, our teacher doesn't believe that life is limited to under the sun, the here and now. His God breaks that envelope at both ends. I'm aware he's one of those teachers who leaves Christians in particular feeling rather edgy. We're not sure that all this talk about meaningless should be in the Bible in the first place. And actually, you find the Christians don't really brighten up that much when they hear someone saying, "Go for it," either. Now, that can be threatening. But listen, He's writing to human beings, believers or not, and his go for it is not a license for immorality, it's actually just wisdom for life. Now, he's agnostic about life. I mean, even as a God believer, he doesn't know what it'll throw at us. There's lots of life we can't predict, isn't there? There's actually lots of life we can't even explain in the here and now. And still he says, go for it. But let me put it this way. It's go for it, or what you might say, how to throw caution to the wind and still stay wise. That's the tone of this chapter. There was a sign up in a factory wall once which read this, don't just sit there, do something. And underneath it someone had chalked up, don't just do something, sit there. By which they meant the real key to things is not just work harder, but work smarter. And I think our teacher would nod at that as well. He's saying live smarter. He's certainly got no time for the fool. I mean, just look across the page and see what he thinks of the fool. I mean, verse 12 of chapter 10. A word from a wise man's mouth are gracious, but a fool is consumed by his own lips. At the beginning his words are folly, at the end they're wicked madness, and the fool multiplies words. The fool's got verbal diarrhea. Or verse 15. A fool's work wearies him. He doesn't know the way to town. You can excuse someone getting lost trying to find a village, but all the signposts tell you where town is. Put the fool on an escalator and he'll get lost. And yet, our teacher wants to say, when it comes to life, the wise advice is go for it. Go for it. If you're one of those who's grown up believing that God has one very particular plan for your life and you're terrified of missing out on it and being reduced simply to a second-rate plan B, and you think you can only be sure you really have found God's plan for your life if everything works out wonderfully well, which, by the way, puts most of us on plan sort of K or Q or who knows where, watch carefully as the teacher picks the locks, releases the chains, opens eyes on life, and gives us permission to live, to go for it. Here's the first point he makes. It's what I've called, it's wise to gamble. It's wise to gamble. Now, I'm not talking about the lottery. You know, that is a fool's game. I'm not actually talking about betting at all. Just the warning to the mindset that waits for life to be risk-free before it ever lets go of anything. Live that way, you'll miss life. See how he begins, verse 1? Cast your bread upon the waters. Now, don't imagine yourself feeding ducks with the children on a pond. Okay, that's not the picture. This is a picture from trade. For after many days, you'll find it again. King Solomon's shipping fleet. It put to sea every 3 years. That's how you traded. You went out, you went to some far country, and you exchanged the goods and brought them back. In business then, just as in business now, you have to invest and then wait for the return. Now here's the encouragement to do that with life. To be a giver, not a clutcher. And to do it generously, liberally. Give portions to 7, yes to 8, he says. They're not precise figures. Don't start counting on the fingers. This isn't statistics, it's proverbs. This is for suspicious, safety-first people whose lives run on that very narrowed, blinkered front. I mean, here's their kind of motto. Get all you can all you get, and sit on the can. Because they're going to give you the next line of verse 2 straight away. For you do not know what disaster may come upon the world. So get all you can all you get, sit on the can. Only they seem to forget where these disasters can come. Sure, Northern Rock Bank can fail. The stock market might plummet. And your home might get robbed, so the sock under the mattress isn't a good place to keep it either. There's no risk-free life plan, is there? You see, our teacher's admitting right from the beginning, here's one of his don't knows. I don't know what might happen. Too true. So go for it. Give portions to 7 or 8. Be as generous as you can while you can. That's wise advice. For you don't know what disaster will come. Our teacher knows only too well it can strike every human being, believer as well as unbeliever. You know, Christians are not immune, are we, from job loss? The dreaded X-ray result. Christians aren't free from children who mess up or parents who won't grow old gracefully. Life's uncertain. Now, the Church of England Pensions Fund is struggling and has been for some while because the actuaries, those who work out risks, have decided that vicars live longer than people from any other profession. There you are. We actually do so little. By the time we retire, you can still stick the as new sign up on us. But verse 2 is just a warning that I shouldn't count on that longer life, so go for it while I can. That's wise advice. If there are risks in everything, I might as well launch out as keep everything to myself. Go for it. Here's the encouragement to adopt a mindset that gives, not gets. That invests in others, not hoards to myself. That serves, not snatches. Not that easy to find, is it? Came across the story of a war correspondent who was watching a nun swab the blood and the pus out of a young soldier's leg. It had gone gangrenous, and the sight repulsed him. He almost gagged as he turned away and mumbled to himself, "I wouldn't do that for $1 million. The nun heard him and looked up and replied, "Neither would I. Neither would I." Well, our teacher says go for it, and the teacher, Jesus, picks up on just this advice and speaks into just this mindset when he said, "Whoever wants to save his life will lose it. Whoever says, get all you can all you get, sit on the can, will lose it. Whoever loses his life, for me and for the gospel, will save it." I wonder if there's anyone tonight who's hovering on the edge of committing to Christ. He knows it feels like losing your life. And yet he says, go for it. It's the way to save it. I remember a friend of mine, he was a very talented sportsman. He just got himself into the team. He was considering the claims of Christ. He came to see me and to talk it over, and he said to me, "Hugh, I realize that everything that's claimed about Jesus is true. I understand it is the truth," he said, "but look, I've just got into the team. I've made loads of new friends. I can't afford to risk them. I can't commit." It looked like losing his life. Actually, it was his way to save it. Whoever loses his life for me and the gospel will save it. Or maybe you're just hesitating because the cost of going on following Jesus is heavy for you. It would cost your job to keep your integrity. You fear it might cost not just friends, but maybe family or partners to own Jesus. It'll feel like losing life. It'll be saving it. Go for it. Go for it. Here's the second point he makes in this chapter, and I put it this way, it's no good sitting on the fence. It's really there in verses 3 and 4. Do you know the kind of people who live life in the world of what might be or what might have been? I mean, they hardly live life sometimes, do they? You know, it rarely gets beyond their mind, their imagination, their talk. "I might have been this, we could have done that, if only such and such hadn't happened." It's a mindset that can be crippling, isn't it? It can guarantee inaction for the future. To live only willing to step out when you can guarantee plain sailing, it's lethal. Our teacher in Ecclesiastes, he lives in the real world. And the real world, doesn't it? It contains certainties that are beyond my control. You know they're going to happen and you can't do anything about them. I mean, here's one in verse 3. If clouds are full of water, they pour rain upon the earth. I mean, you don't need to be that wise to understand it, do you? It will rain. Just a matter of when and where, and there's not a lot you and I can do about it. Or try the next thing he says down here in verse 3. This could hardly be blunter, could it? Whether a tree falls to the south or to the north, in the place where it falls, it lies. You didn't think you'd come to church tonight to learn that, did you? Well, there you are. Here's something to put in your brain box for the week. And there's no point in moaning, is there? You know, have you ever driven along a road after one of these gales and discovered there's a tree right across it? There's not a lot of point in sitting in the car and saying, hey, look, if it had only fallen the other way. Oh, I wonder if it could possibly fall just a few feet, you know, over there. Then we could get by. Where it falls, it lies. Friends, in case you hadn't worked it out, trees don't crawl. And that's all he's saying, really, isn't it? And the real world contains certainties beyond our control. We can't do anything about them. And some people seem to go on for years, decades even, with their life blocked by the tree that's fallen across their path. You'll know someone, don't you? You talk to them and they'll be full of the bad luck, the rough justice, the misfortune of it all, but with a life that seems to be left on a permanent hold, as if it can't be lived until the tree crawls away. It's not going to. There are certainties beyond our control. There are also always uncertainties we can't control. And they can leave us missing out on life too, can't they? Look at verse 4. Whoever watches the wind will not plant. Whoever looks at the clouds will not reap. You get the picture, don't you? Oh, I think it might rain today. Oh, perhaps we're going to leave it till tomorrow. Oh, do you think it's rather blowy? It might be less blowy. I mean, could have been written for British weather, couldn't it? And you know, if you've been a Brit for long enough, you work out after a bit, it is no good waiting for that wonderful sort of, you know, wind-free, sunny day. It comes once a year. If all I'm going to do is will it, won't it, and I've got to be sure before, I'll never live. He speaks into the kind of uncertainty that breeds hesitancy for some people. They'll say to themselves, look, I don't know whether this will happen or that will happen. So you spend your life sitting on the fence? No. Go for it, you say. Eugene Peterson, in his translation of this, puts these verses this way. When the clouds are full of water, it rains. When the wind blows down a tree, it lies where it falls. Don't sit there watching the weather. Do your own work. Don't stare at the clouds. Get on with your life. He's got it, hasn't he? Don't wait for the weather to change. Don't wait for the kids to grow up, the promotion to be in the bag, the degree to be finished, conditions to be perfect and risk-free before you climb off the fence and live. Again, Jesus, the teacher. He said once, he who is not with me is against me. There's no neutrality when it comes to Christ. No good thinking we are sitting on the fence. In the end, those are the ones who get most hurt, actually. Are you frightened by commitment? Worried about what it might bring? Or always waiting for a better moment? No, go for it. Nail your colours to the mast. At the next opportunity, come out decisively for Christ. And really, to the seasoned Christian, as well as to the one on the edge, that's the advice, isn't it? I was reading of Chuck Swindoll, the American pastor, and he told a great story of a couple of months after he married his wife. He joined the Marine Corps. The recruiting officer promised he'd never go overseas. He, as he said, was stupid enough to believe him, and a few months later he finds himself 8,000 miles away in Okinawa. He said, I realized I was facing the challenge of my sheltered life. Here he is, wet behind the ears, just married, a Christian. I was told the outfit I was to become a part of was shot through with venereal disease. The lifestyle on the island was somewhere between morally loose and absolutely debauched. I was a married man. I was also a Christian. I wanted to have an impact. I wanted to be different, but I was scared. I had a bunkmate named Eddie. I spoke to Eddie about Christ early on, and he wasn't interested, and he made it clear to me, I don't want that stuff ran down my throat, okay? You live your life, I live mine. Got it? So I honored Eddie's request. Little did I realize how much he was watching me. And Swindoll went on to say, he got into a scripture memory program. And he wanted to reach Eddie, and he was at a loss to know how. And one day it occurred to him, well, he doesn't want me to witness to him, but maybe he'll help me review my verses. He's got a lot of time on his hands. So I said, Eddie, tell you what, I'm going over these verses from the Bible, and I wonder if you'd help me review them. And he said, yep, but don't lay your trip on me, okay? Don't lay your thing on me. I'll help you with the words, but I ain't interested in becoming some kind of monk. Well, I smiled and agreed with the plan, and we went over these verses month after month after month after month. Dear guy, he listened, he corrected me, he even encouraged me, but he never once responded. There was never a glimmer of interest in Eddie's part. No way. Not until more than 25 years later. And my phone rang. Charlie? Because they called him Charlie in those days. Yeah, who's this? This is Eddie, your old bunk buddy on Okinawa. Eddie, how are you? Hey, listen, man, I've been saved. My wife, too. Thanks for living for Christ. I was speechless. You know, remember when you used to lay those verses on me? Yeah, I remember. Charlie, it worked. Conditions were not promising when the seed was sown, were they? You know, whoever watches the wind won't plant. Whoever looks at the clouds won't reap. In 1958, Chuck Swindoll was sowing. In 1984, God brought in the sheaves. Hey, go for it. Here's the third point he makes. What I call the ignorance is no excuse. Now, our teacher is still agnostic. He's not in the dark about God, but there's so much about life he doesn't know. He can't answer all the whys and the whats and the whethers. And now, you notice as you look down at verse 5, he doesn't know how either. See what he says, verse 5? As you don't know the path of the wind, he can't predict the wind. But then the Met Office doesn't always get it right either, does it? Or how the body is formed in a mother's womb. Now, it's not sex education he's lacking. It's just that he's marveling at the mystery of it all, of how a shape, a body, bones, delicate fingers and toes grow. I can't explain how. Well, in just the same way, he says, you can't understand the work of God, the maker of all things. There are loads of things we don't know in life. Don't wait till you've got them all solved before you live. Go for it. That's what he's saying in verse 6. And don't be paralyzed by inevitability or uncertainty or ignorance. Enjoy life. Sow your seed in the morning. And at evening, let not your hands be idle. That's a great phrase. Sow your seed in the morning. And at evening, let not your hands be idle. It's difficult to know if this is just an encouragement to be flexible, take every opportunity you can, make the most of the time, or whether it's really to keep going for it in the twilight of your life, as well as in your youth. Probably worth taking it both ways. Certainly a good reminder to us, isn't it, not to reach for the armchair and slippers too quickly. You know, don't hit retirement and put up the do not disturb sign. William Gladstone became Prime Minister at 83. John Wesley was preaching daily and powerfully at 88. Michelangelo painted the Last Judgment at 66. Go for it, any which way you can, any time you can. For, you see how verse 6 ends? You do not know which will succeed, whether this or that, or whether both will do equally well. So go for it. And the teacher, Jesus, he uses just this kind of illustration when he talks about the kind of life that is a must for the kingdom of heaven. explaining what it means to be born from above, Jesus said, "The wind blows where it pleases. You hear its sound, but you cannot tell where it comes from or where it's going." So it is with everyone born of the Spirit. Get what he's saying? There is not a DIY manual for how to get yourself born again, or the steps you need to follow and the procedures to take, and then your friend will be born again. It's God's work. Andrew was an architect student, and he tried to win his second year friend for Christ, and he was doing that patiently and well when he bumped into a fresher who tagged along as they went to hear preachers explain the gospel. The second year debated, engaged with the ideas. The fresher was just a wet rag who sort of dumbly nodded and carried on. But 12 months later, the fresher repented. 30 years later, the second year still hasn't. The fresher today is the rector of All Souls. And I'll be eternally grateful that Andrew sowed in both directions. He didn't know which one would bear fruit. So easy, isn't it, to drift through the week without thinking of sowing gospel seeds, or imagining they'd never take root. Just because I can't see how someone could get spiritual life doesn't mean do nothing. I came across a fascinating email from an American who was just thinking of the people who passed through his country. Fidel Castro came to the States as a prospect for Major League Baseball, but he found Americans inhospitable and didn't stick around. Before long, Cuba fell to communism. Haile Mengistu, an Ethiopian, studied at a military institute in Virginia, but he saw enough racist attitudes and behavior directed at him that he had enough. Ethiopia fell to his dictatorial boot after he returned. Leon Trotsky had no Christian contact in New York City, and he returned to Russia, where he helped Vladimir Lenin overthrow the Russian Tsar and establish the Soviet Union. Ho Chi Minh came to the States from France, and in correspondence he wrote to a friend, he said, he came here to find the secret of capitalism and Christianity. He left disillusioned, embraced communism, led North Vietnam in war against the States. Matsuki studied in the West Coast, was treated as the lamentable foreigner, and so bitter were his experiences here that he returned to Japan, vowing to get even. He did. He planned the attack on Pearl Harbor. How might history have been rewritten for millions upon millions of people in the gulags, running for their lives, starving to death, caught in the crossfire of wars, if only those five men had been contacted by God's people who were living Christian, loving Christian witnesses and friends? The fact is, no one made any significant Christian contact with any of them. And friends, if someone had sent me the email, we could do the same story for the UK. Go for it. Be urgent, in season and out of season. Sow your seed this way and that way. It's 3D. I mean, opportunities galore, aren't there? And a God who could use a candlelit dinner, a corrupt, convicted MP, Scottish dancing? Well, if he can use them, so can we. Go for it. So in the morning, the evening, you don't know which will succeed, whether this or that, or whether both. Go for it, friends. Let's pray. Gracious God, in an uncertain world, give us the confidence and the boldness to make the most of life and all its opportunities. For Jesus' sake, Amen.